stay on it. We may not be able to graze it the first season. It might be the second season or the third season. I saw a permit the other day that was issued in, for not for one energy project, but for another project, and I want to say it was Ohio. And the condition on that was that their grazing had to start within, I think, 5 years of start. I don't know if it'd take 5 years, but it's certainly not the first year.
Yeah, and your application talked about monthly mowing as part of it.
I don't know if we need to mow monthly here. And certainly not for grazing, she doesn't have to mow much at all. So monthly mowing would be excessive.
So explain the different construction techniques are required if you're going to have panels high enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Clean enough.
So with sheep, the beauty of sheep and what makes them easier to graze than cattle is that we don't have to do anything different from a height perspective. Sheep don't climb on the panels like goats do. There have been some very early pilot projects grazing cattle under these solar panels. They have to elevate the panels quite a bit, and they really have to beef up the piles or put in more piles, otherwise they rub on the piles and bend the whole thing. So sheep are really ideal. They're not, like I said, they're not climbing around as much as goats, and they're not as heavy enough to bend the piles. So that works great for us. Like I said, a lot of it is wire management, making things sure things that wires are closed or well connected and not hanging out, which is good practice anyway, so it's not really an extra cost for us or anything.
It's not a different construction method.
Which makes it really, really good for us, yeah.
I didn't see anywhere in your application where it talked about specifically mulching as a conditional use. Is that something that could be?
It would be anyway. There's just no other way for us to get stuff to grow.
So that doesn't mean I've seen some of the stuff. And it's like we said, we'd seen it. We just checked the box. We seeded it. Okay.
Sure. I think depending on the other.
Okay.
I think we would need it to meet many conditions of the permit. But if you wanted to make that, I don't think I'd have a problem with that if it was to be a condition. The other thing that can really help, and I can hear Cameron saying this behind me in a set already, but. Any chance we get to seed before construction starts, or to do our grading first and then seed, give it a season to germinate and then come out and do construction. That gives us a head start and helps get things established. So it depends on time of year and when construction starts is very much it's unfortunate. It ends up being a financial thing when we can get financial.
A little bit of solar that I've seen looks like it's pretty intrusive to the soil. Maybe I haven't seen as much as you did.
In terms of?
Impact, just.
Nothing.
Oh, sure. Yeah. We've really been able to move away from that in recent years.
Even put on existing stands of CRP ground where there was an existing stand of grass to begin with, and then after construction there was not.
Is it because there's typically like a sterilant or something that is put down?
No, it's just construction.
It's just traffic.
I haven't seen a lot of them, so I've only seen a couple of farms constructed.
Yeah. Where's my thing here? So this is a one energy project in Wisconsin, so you can see we've got things growing back.
Yeah, right? That's not that site.
That's not
going to the county. I
understand. That looks really bright.
Compaction is going to impact you whether you're in an arid climate or a more moderate climate. So if compaction, we've worked with that. I'm going to go way back here, but this is a one energy project as well, as is this one. So this is all pollinator habitat. These are all black-eyed Susans. So you can kind of see where the compaction maybe is an issue in between those rows a little bit, where it's a little bit tougher sometimes. That's where they're driving heavy equipment to drop off materials. But you don't even in between rows, you don't get that much compaction. This is, I think, a couple years after, maybe 2 years after construction completed. So again, more rainfall, but the compaction issues, generally, the contractors that we use are pretty good about.
So I'd maintain in areas that are 30, 35 bushel wheat ground, and you have a market like we have right now, it may be a better use of the property. Like I graze cattle, and we have a lot of former wheat ground, and I'm not sure that I could make a profit more than what I'm making with the cattle by doing wheat on it these days. I mean, I'm, with the added revenue of the solar plus the sheep on it, I love it. I think it's great. It's going to be weed control, chemical.
The sheep grazing has been a conversation that's been brought up in the past and has mostly been downplayed, so it's encouraging to hear.
Yeah, but it's still an ag use, but, you know, a lot of our GAP practices require that we have shade for our livestock, and that certainly qualifies for that.
I mean, but to me, the challenge is establishing, establishing some grasses. That's the harder part.
I was curious, maybe it's in your new packet, but how long do the sheep graze the area? Is it a certain number of months or weeks?
Cameron, in the packet, it's, you know, we're working with Mr. Krebs here. We've signed an LOI, and we're working towards getting him under contract. He can talk more to it during public comment, but he grazes another site in Umatilla County 12 months out of the year. So it may not be that. It might be a little bit of a different setup. I'll let him speak to it.
Because what happens when it's not being grazed is it just back? How do you control the weeds? How do you control the tumbleweeds and the fences? How do you how do you take care of the fire hazards then when they're not on site?
Yeah, that would be it's not just a grazing contract with Krebs Solar. It would be a full vegetation management contract. So he's got a system worked out to where he's making sure that he's got the forage down to where it needs to be during the growing season, and then when it's drier out, not going to grow as much, he might move his sheep off, and then move them back on again. And that'll be, you know, it'll be a contractual obligation for him to make sure he maintains that.
So there could be some spraying and mechanical mowing required?
There could be.
Like if you move off and kosher comes in, you're going to have to do something.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be able to plant legumes if you're going to have to control weeds.
Sure.
You're going to kill them.
Yeah, and sometimes that happens because sheep don't, you know, forage on everything perfectly evenly. So it's all about proper management. And then if you need to have a subcontractor do some mechanical mowing or take care of a specific weed problem that it might show up, then
and you probably want to work pretty tight too because you don't want a fire.
Exactly. Yeah. It's,
fire would be bad.
It works for us on multiple levels.
I see that fencing and all I see are sagebrush, tumbleweed stuck in it. So, you know, I mean, I'm just curious how that's going to be mitigated too.
Yeah. Well, it's been a challenge on the existing ones. She's bringing it up, but whether it's within the project or outside the project, the Russian thistle blowing up or mustard blowing up and getting stuck on those cyclone fences.
We have an obligation even to the landowner to make sure that we're not, you know, having weed infestation moving on to their agricultural operations as well. So it's kind of, you know, we're all trying to work together to make sure we're managing our site properly and having a good working relationship.
And to add on to that, the proposed conditions of approval in the conditional use permit would require the applicant to work with the county and county weed master in finalizing this vegetation and weed management plan, and then implement the veg and weed management plan for the life of the project. And so there would be ongoing obligation to adhere to that, and that the county would have the ability to require ongoing compliance. So that's
kind of
a bootstrap insurance.
Where do you find a contractor that can hypermulch 800 acres in a
I don't know that they're here in town, but we have. I have two specific.
They're out there.
Seriously.
We put a call out locally, but we have two that we've worked with across the country. One based out of Wisconsin. They've got a branch in Colorado. They're almost exclusively about solar vegetation maintenance and revegetation. Then their business has grown so much. They're based in Wisconsin. They opened an office just last year in Colorado, and then I've got some folks in Texas Panhandle as well. So. Folks that are experienced with solar and experienced with air climates.
I worked on a project recently, a wind project in Sherman County, where we brought in a similar product and had to do several hundreds of acres. I think they called it Gorilla Snot was the tactifier that they were using or something like that.
That's the brand name of tactifier, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely a a method that's being implemented at these large utility scale renewable projects, just given the extent of temporary impact associated with the construction activities. And then just to go back to this, the seeding and the re-veg, I think Nathan mentioned a good point with respect to the vegetation is trying to get the seeds established early or working with ODFW and the Weed Master to identify seed mixes that are appropriate for the soils. I'm working on another project down in Lake County where they're doing some plot testing on 400-acre plots. I have a couple 400-acre plots to test the right seeds in order to work with vegetation management, just to address some of the issues that you guys were talking about. So lots going on in this area.
Yeah, anybody that farms out there knows that planting grasses is a challenge. There's just very few species that can survive in that low rainfall, and then getting them to germinate and grow is...
Yeah.
It's not easy. Yeah.
You want to go to the next slide, Nathan?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to switch gears from goal three and... unless there are any further questions on Goal 3 exception and the request there, we'll move on to the conditional use permit and the applicable criteria for the CUP. Okay. So for the conditional use permit, the applicable criteria for your review come from both the county code and then from ORS 215-446. That provides additional siting standards for solar projects of our project size. And so throughout the staff report, you'll see proposed findings for how applicant meets the applicable criteria. There's quite a robust staff report on the CUP. We support the proposed findings of fact in the staff report and don't have much to add to it. I did want to highlight the different plans that will be implemented during construction and operation to address potential impacts. This goes to some of the items we were talking about, in that there will be several plans that will be implemented during construction and operation that passage will be required to adhere to. And these all require ongoing coordination with the county and final approval of these plans prior to construction or operation, depending on the plan. The one condition we did recommend some revisions with modifications to condition 3. Otherwise, we're supportive of all the conditions. We suggested red line for condition 3 in our supplemental materials filed today to, instead of requiring an agricultural mitigation plan, to require that the grazing program be implemented in the vegetation and weed management plan in consultation with the county prior to construction, and that the county would have the opportunity to review that that final plan. That would work hand in hand with condition 12, that requires the applicant to coordinate with the county weed supervisor in finalizing the weed plan. The next slide. With respect to 215-446, this was legislation that passed in 2019 that gave counties greater jurisdiction over renewable energy projects, so that more renewable energy projects could go through county siting rather than having to go to FSAC siting. What this statute does is it essentially adopts into local codes some of the state level siting standards with respect to wildlife, cultural resources, and decommissioning. And so for this project, we had consultation with ODFW to identify the habitat type across the project site. This is category 6 habitat, which is the lowest category of habitat. Cultivated ag land usually is category 6, and therefore no mitigation is required. So we will be working with ODFW to document that for the record and have that on file prior to construction. With respect to cultural and historic resources, we've been in consultation with SHPO and the CTUIR. Passage is continuing to work with the CTIR on cultural resource surveys and are in discussions for confidential mitigation agreement. And so that is something we've been keeping the county updated on and will continue to do so as part of our conditions of approval if you approve the CUP. And then finally, with respect to decommissioning, applicant will provide financial assurance for 100% of the decommissioning costs, and then the applicant will work with the county prior to construction to establish the timing for that bond or financial assurance letter of credit in a form acceptable to the county.
Elaine, would you explain to me a confidential mitigation agreement?
Yeah.
In regards to ground's been farmed for 80 years?
Say that again.
Ground's been plowed and farmed for 80 years. What are we mitigating?
Yeah, so the CTUIR treats certain areas as, maybe traditional cultural properties or areas of historic significance to them, and those are not documented in the public record for their request. And so the mitigation agreement includes measures to address those, sensitive areas, and that they don't want that information disclosed publicly.
I got you.
Tanner, I don't know if you have more to add on that. You've been leading some of those discussions.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't. I think that pretty much covers exactly what it is.
Okay.
Yep.
So what might that mitigation entail?
It's really up to that discussion with the tribes.
That's confidential.
That's something we worked out with them. We would be providing that to the county, but it would not be a public record available to the public. And so we're still working through those discussions with the tribes. And so it's all tribes are different, right? They all have their own, resources and traditions. And so we're still working through that, and we'll provide updates as we move through that.
We have to do that for our drain field for our sewer project. And they spent several days up in the 38 acres looking for something. I think they found an old Coke bottle. So they're just looking for, make sure it's not something like arrowheads and things.
Right.
Yeah. And I can share based on other projects, sometimes mitigation might be, documenting elder oral histories or offering access to first foods if there's particular resources on a project site, things like that.
Yeah. No, I was referring specifically to this project. I understand the need for it, but anyway.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? At a meeting recently, we had adopted any decommissioning of solar. That there needed to be a plan when they came to retirement. Mm-hmm. Is that submitted?
That's right there.
It just says their cost would be covered or no plan.
No, she referred to a bond.
So that's just financial, but it doesn't give us the steps to decommission. Like, how does that happen?
The decommissioning plan's included in your packet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Number 7, condition 7.
No, I'm glad you're checking that.
Yeah, it's required for. I don't know which attachment it is.
It's N. It's attachment N to the application.
And there'll be a bond in place.
Page 198.
Oh,
page 198.
Yeah, it works in tandem with condition 7 in the recommended conditions in the staff report, which requires that.
198.
Applicant provides the financial assurance of 100% of estimated costs in accordance with the approved decommissioning plan, and that the county has proof of financial assurance prior to construction. And then, so then the decommissioning plan was provided as a part of the application and includes discussion of the steps to decommission it and the process to go through decommissioning to return it to its prior condition. And that's attachment N to the application, and I can pinpoint the record if I get a chance.
Page 198 on the packet, if anyone's...
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
And our understanding of condition 7 is that we work with the county prior to construction to provide proof of financial assurance, and then the timing of the bond, of actually placing the bond or letter of credit, is something that's decided at that time with the county. That's how we read condition 7.
So is it a bond or a letter of credit?
I think it's a financial assurance acceptable to the county. In my experience, it has been, people have used different forms depending on the county's preference and depending on what is kind of the company's go-to mechanism.
Bonds are unusual.
Yeah. We had that discussion at the Board of Commissioners level because they were very much in favor of adopting our decommissioning requirement, but what... A bond or letter of credit isn't valuable if the company goes bad, but then what else do you use? And Daisy and I last week were at the State Energy Facility Setting Council meeting. They use the same language, so we're all in the same sort of predicament. Nobody
thinks since
that.
Wind started coming in here, and now more so solar, that's been the question that landowners have always had.
Yeah.
Isn't the bonding company responsible if it goes sour?
But if they are delinquent on their payments.
Policy.
Yeah.
So what's the remedy if they don't make the payment on the bond?
I think we don't know.
Yeah. I think that's
you have
to get comfortable.
I'm not sure.
Under what's the answer?
under the state siting process, the state may require upon request or as part of annual reports, status of the financial assurance. So that could be something that, as part of condition 7, you know, like as upon request.
Actually, that's a good idea.
Applicant will provide ongoing, you know, ongoing assurance of the financial assurance or something. We can get some language, but it's something that the county has the ability to request, I would think.
That makes sense too. When I read that again, it wasn't in there, but I think adding to number 7 that, you know, submit annual proof of a bond or letter of credit is a good idea. That's what we normally see. It wasn't explicit, so adding that would be, at least you know if it's old, it might only be a year old.
Isn't that in part of our lease, you guys, that there is a review of the bond?
In my experience with bonds, too, is if you don't pay it, the bonding company gets a little owly and they are telling everybody that you haven't done it.
We lose our bonding ability for anything.
But I don't think it's a bad thing to require. Yeah. So.
And these conditions are looking out for the county and the general public. Yeah. The agreement between the landowner and the developer is a separate third-party agreement to protect the landowner.
It is, yeah.
You know, that's something that we never really talked about when we did wind leases. There's just a bond, but we never got into what if the bond company says see you later.
Yeah.
So in this, it's a little bit different. So. Hopefully. It'll come out of these guys' wages.
100 shows paid my paycheck on time for what it's worth, so. All right. Anything else on decommissioning? All right. All right, I'll take it back from you, Elaine, if that's all right. Diving back into the project specifics a little bit. So we've talked about the layout. We've looked at it. We've talked about the difference between the project area extent, project area itself. Some other items I just wanted to point out, that the project does comply with all the setbacks in the county code. Access, I have a better slide on access in a couple slides here, but that's going to be to the south via Highway 207, and there are no known inventory significant natural resource areas than 100 feet of the site boundary. In terms of construction, the project this size, it usually takes about 12 months to construct. And that 12 months is from, you know, first pickup on site to all the way through to testing and making sure that, you know, it's good to go, sending power to the grid. So it's not intensive construction use for 12 full months. In fact, the last about 3-4 months, there's almost nobody on site, and we're just working on testing and getting everything commissioned. At peak of construction, that's estimated about 300 jobs are going to be created, mostly falling under electrical workers, equipment operators in general. And as I mentioned before, the earliest possible start date, and this would be a little bit ambitious right now, but it would be early 2025 with the earliest possible online date of the end of year 2025, early 2026. Project life is expected to be approximately 35 years. There is a potential to update some of the equipment to extend the project life. That would be essentially replacing the solar panels themselves. In 35 years, we would expect to have better panels. But all of this would be depending on our landowners being willing to extend their lease as well. Solar, in terms of operations and maintenance, pretty minimal on-site maintenance. They're remotely monitored, so we know that if they're not, you know, performing correctly, there's something wrong. And somebody can be dispatched to go check it out on site. Routine as-needed maintenance checks, a couple trips a month kind of thing to clear the tumbleweeds out of the fence and make sure that fire danger is low and replace a cracked panel or something like that if something like that happens. And we've talked about the grazing thing at length. And then decommissioning. The objective of decommissioning is to restore the site to the same condition as it was before we built it or better. Most of the equipment gets either recycled or salvaged. The salvage value of the site usually covers the cost of decommissioning in itself. And then we'd be restoring any disturbed soils, removing fences and roads, unless for some reason the landowner wanted to keep a road out there for their own use or something like that. And then, yeah, what we had proposed in our application was providing that bond at later of either 10 years after operations or at the end of the power purchase agreement term. That's pretty industry standard. We see, you know, different companies require different things, so we can discuss that at a later date, I think, is what Elaine is saying. All right, and then this is access here. A couple of notes here. All right, so yeah, like I said, the red shape there is the project site. We didn't trace the road all the way, but if you look to the bottom of the middle or of the right hand image, there's Highway 207, and the yellow line coming north off of that is the only section of the access that's not owned by Tim Shane Rust. So we're currently negotiating with that landowner for an access easement off of there. We've spoken to ODOT about accessing off of or using this road off of 207. There's an existing permitted access there, or approach, sorry. So they're not requiring any additional access permitting. You can see here, peak construction is estimated to last only 1 to 4 weeks in terms of traffic. So those are 1 to 4 weeks are materials delivery, piles, trackers, and modules, getting those delivered on site. That would be, those are the heavy vehicles or delivery trucks in that case, 40 to 50 per day. And like I said, 1 to 4 weeks there. And then personnel, assuming that folks are carpooling a little bit, 150 round trips per day to site. And that, again, just a peak. So. Operations traffic, as I mentioned, limited to maintenance crews, vegetation maintenance visits, a couple semis to bring sheep on and off.
Can I ask a question? Whose property are you crossing? Is it private road to get to Highway 207?
Perkins.
It's all private.
Perkins.
Yeah.
It's an NNC, land LLC.
Farms.
Okay.
It used to be farms. It changed to land.
And this is different than the two alternatives you included in the transportation plan?
This is one of the proposed alternatives we had initially included within our application. And now our discussions have progressed more with this landowner, and we've had those discussions with ODOT as well. So we wanted to present it today to make sure that it's clear.
So
that
is that a condition of approval then?
Yeah, we might just want to add it as a condition. I mean, obviously your project's not going to go anyplace if you don't have an access easement from the neighbor.
You can go by Shannon's house.
We won't be able to get title insurance if we don't have a recorded easement.
The condition says applicant shall obtain all necessary access or crossing easements, agreements, or permits to establish legal access to the project site.
That sounds good. Yeah.
And then the easement widths and access standards need to be compliant with our TSP and MCZO. So I think that covers it.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, it does.
second page there. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Mm-hmm. All right, last slide. Quick timeline here. We've touched on it before, but we threw it anyway. Through to the end of 2024, development and permitting. Again, earliest possible construction start date would be early 2025, or the earliest completion date, end of 2025, and then from there on, operations and maintenance. So, all right. Thank you for bearing with us. That's what I had.
Do you have a security, cybersecurity plan done for it?
We have nothing super specific, a cybersecurity plan. We work with, we're required to work with Unitil Electric and VPA, mostly VPA, on communications for the site. So we're, you know, we have to meet all of their standards. Yeah. Now, VPAs are stricter than UEs. Questions for me, or if not, we can move on to the
procedure. Yeah, the question from the planning commissioners of these two gentlemen.
So my question, if it's okay, is what's the estimated project value and how is this taxed? So it's a big deal to me as a planning commissioner that we look out for the tax situation in this county.
Right.
So that's kind of a big deal to me, is how this is taxed and where it goes. And
mm-hmm. To be determined, and we can have this conversation now, or I think it would happen with the Board of County Commissioners to finalize this after permitting, but the county allows a payment in lieu of taxes or pilot program mm-hmm. where we pay a certain number of dollars per megawatt per year for up to 20 years, I believe, is in the code. And I believe $7,000 is sort of the...
Per megawatt.
Yeah, per megawatt.
Is that what,
for up to 20
is that
years.
Kind of what the landmark is right now, $7,000 a megawatt?
Yep.
So we'll do the Elvis with the math there.
$840,000.
Yeah.
One-time payment.
Yeah. Per
year.
Per year.
Per year.
Per year for up to 20 years. Yeah.
And that's a general fund.
It's not just one fund. I do believe it gets spread across the applicable tax districts.
So actually, that's a different department. It does make sense to keep your regulatory folks separate from those incentive folks. But the pilot program and then a SIP agreement are both options. This is a greater value than $25 million or $50 million, right?
It would be, yeah. It would be about that.
Okay. Right. So if it's over $50 million, then they can qualify for a SIP agreement. So you can negotiate those two options.
And that hasn't been negotiated yet?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
And just some developers, that is one of the things they negotiate really early on, and some, like One Energy, do that a little bit later.
I think you'd be a better negotiator before it was built.
Well, actually, I think the way the state regs, you have to have that agreement in place before construction begins.
Yeah.
But they probably didn't want to do that until this was permitted.
Yeah, it was. We weren't really sure entirely whether we should do the pilot first or the permit first, and we chose the permit.
I think there's only one other project in our county that has the pilot. That's the Pine Gate Renewables.
Is it?
But the other renewable energy projects are SIP agreements.
Okay.
And the pilot is what we've been looking at least for our internal models. So.
Okay, good.
So really, another question.
My question, and I'm not sure if it's for the planning department, on test two, it makes reference to the goal exception, and it says the applicant prepares a goal 3 alternative analysis that reviewed and analyzed potential sites within Morrow County that met the siting criteria and such land use acreages and interconnection ability. But it shows that there are no other sites in Morrow County that meet the project's defined siting criteria that would require a goal exception. Explain that to me.
It starts on page 26 if you want to read their alternatives analysis.
Seems like a pretty broad assumption.
I mean, we have 18,000 acres of proposed solar right now in Morrow County. And
I think...
So I'm trying to handle what makes this special that we need to make an exception when we know there's 18,000 acres that are proposed.
You can speak to it.
Okay. I think one of the big ones that narrows it down, and this differentiates us from a lot of the other proposed solar projects in the county, is the size of the project. A lot of the other ones are very large. They're able to interconnect to very large transmission lines. You know, there's a lot of transmission lines in the county. A lot of them are at 500,000 volts, you know, 345,000 volts or 230,000 volts.
Okay.
To be able to interconnect a project to those voltages, you need a transformer that is big enough to step up to that voltage. The bigger the voltage, the more expensive the transformer. So you lose out on economies of scale. You wouldn't be able to interconnect a 100 megawatt solar farm onto a 500 kV line because the cost of that transformer would not be covered by the money generated by that project. You would need a project that's 500 or more megawatts just to afford the transformer itself, right? It's very much an economy of scale thing. So we are targeting a smaller project in the 100 megawatt range, which means that we need to target transmission infrastructure in that, you know, 100 kilovolt range. 115 and 138 are the most common 100 kilovolt voltages. So that narrows it down to some pretty specific lines owned by UEC in the county. So that takes quite a bit of the county out of play right there. And then there's, you know, we need to be within a certain distance of the existing infrastructure, and we're about 3 miles of Gentile line away from the Oregon Trail substation, which is about the max that we could afford. That's a pretty expensive line to build, that 3 miles. And again, the bigger your project is, the more you can spend on a single thing. So a big project could maybe be located 20 miles away from the existing infrastructure. A smaller project has to be located closer to existing infrastructure just to be able to afford, again, the Gentile line, the big transformer. Those are sort of the big ticket items. So just that, just the size component of it, I know it's a little bit counterintuitive. We have a smaller project. Wouldn't there be more places we could put it? But because of the infrastructure part of that, it really narrows down where we can locate our project. And then you layer the other 8 criteria on top of that, and it narrows it down pretty quickly. And the final one that is really the, I'll call it the nail in the coffin, is that you need a landowner that wants to work with you. Mm-hmm. Not everybody does.
Now, Elaine mentioned that there was an alternate site, but it wasn't reasonable. It sounded like there was just one that was close.
And that's the Umatilla Army Depot.
Okay.
So yeah, that would, I think, fall under the willing landowner, willing and able landowner. They're they're doing their own process right now for that kind of thing.
You can see why it was confusing.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's
absolutely.
18,000
yeah.
acres proposed yeah. right now. Mm-hmm. So it looks like there's a lot of land available.
Very understandable.
Or more than that, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, the alternatives analysis is very thorough, and that's the gist of it.
It's just as a side note, it's interesting to see the different business formulas with all the different renewable companies. So this business model is looking for a smaller, it's a niche market, not the 7,000 acres.
That we're now classifying an 800 acre solar farm as small.
I think I said smaller, just to be clear.
I mean, you said you had 240 megawatts of solar existent and 50 projects?
Yeah, exactly. So
five megawatts per project.
Exactly. Most of the projects that One Energy builds are smaller.
I'm going to make an argument that if you're grazing, you have taken it out of ag.
Yeah.
That's what they wanted you to hear. That's what they wanted you to say.
Yeah.
They're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars at some of these feedlots putting up shades right now. So I think it's a great idea.
No,
we should get
the
phone number and see if they want solar shades. That's Aaron's favorite idea is solar canopy.
Hard to say what that might be worth getting sheep in there. I mean, you'd have to pay a lot to get sheep in there.
You can pay.
Can I just recap kind of where we are? Daisy and I had a call with the development team yesterday. It's Tuesday, and then Elaine and the crew followed up with this alternative language. So if you are inclined to agree and inclined to approve, I'm pretty comfortable with that.
I would say I really like the supplemental findings that Elaine proposed. I think it's really good, and I also agree that the sheep grazing is a totally acceptable agricultural mitigation strategy. I would say, though, as far as the revised condition 3, the submission of a vegetation plan that incorporates sheep grazing doesn't necessarily like ensure that that's going to be successful or productive. So I would want to maybe make a little bit more specific language that gives us a little bit of legs if it doesn't work out, or if we look back, like, you know, in that agreement, to be able to either reanalyze the Goal 3 analysis or ensure the continuation of the grazing program. Yeah, exactly.
Can I just request that maybe Cameron answer my question, because nobody actually answered my question.
Oh, what was it?
No, my question was, how long do the sheep actually graze it during the year?
Oh, yeah.
And then what happens when they aren't there? How does it impact the environment or the solar panels or the ground or whatever?
Yeah, thank you for the question. My name is Cameron Krebs. You want me to spell it out for your record here? CameronKrebs. So the strategy, I think they're, first of all, thank you for serving your time. My thought to answer your question is vegetation grows 12 months a year in our county. It just doesn't always grow evenly in 12 months a year in our county. So the first section of vegetation focuses on biomass reduction for fire prevention, so consuming carbon and converting it into wool shirts and leg lambs. And then in the summer months, we're going to try to focus in on thistles, tarweed, kochia, and then into the fall months, as that hardens up and the cheatgrass comes back on, get a jump back in on the ladder fuels that cause fire issues for the site. So it's a 12-month grazing program, a model, but doesn't mean the sheep would be on site every single day, but it also doesn't mean that the same number of sheep will be on site in the duration of 12 months. So, you know, peaking during the spring grazing season, reduction of livestock through the summer, and our changing classifications of sheep, and that is being developed right now in our modeling and some testing to match our climatic zone here in the Columbia Basin.
So you anticipate rotating the sheep, rotating what type of sheep, age of sheep or something like that, whatever?
Yeah, so, you know, we still need to have replacement ewes to breed out, so getting, you know, as the nutrition falls off, working with the nutritionist, maybe changing to weathers or changing to, you know, feeder lambs in the spring would work good. But, you know, feeder lambs in the fall isn't going to work so well just from an animal welfare standpoint. So just meeting the nutritional availability of the landscape to a classification of sheep that can convert that nutrition in a sustainable fashion. And trying to basically reduce the biomass generated when it's short and green over the course of 12 months.
So do you think you'll implement, like, some hot wires in there to keep them, like, rotate them through it so they can make them eat, or will they all go to one spot? Or
on a site?
Yes, I mean, yeah. Not important to this.
Not to get too far in the weeds, but on a site this size, we'll just herd them.
Yeah, okay.
It's 700 acres, right? Yeah. So we'll break it into sub-zones, target zones. Any site that's an environmental sensitive area, we're getting overuse, we asked about reseeding. You know, we're going to be managing these sheep in a standpoint that we don't want to damage the vegetation to have to recause hydro seeding for the company. So it's having a vegetative profile, managing it through the grazing season, letting it go to seed at times so we can put that back into the soil and build up a healthy soil ecosystem, which is benefit to the site and the people here. So I kind of look at it in two phases. One is biofuel reduction, that's the spring through June. And then June or July 1 through the rest of the year, as everyone in the room, that's a weed control. So it's, you know, fuel load reduction and then weed reduction.
How many water sources do you think?
Sheep are desert animals. So, and, you know, we'll just, depending lactation, we're going to just, we'll need not a lot of water. They're not a cow.
I was just going to go one or two of them.
We'll manage them on the site. At certain times, if we use some set stocking, you know, when we have the smaller herd numbers in the summer, to get them to move into areas with the water and salt mineral location. So there may be three or four water sites, but we might shut some off to draw the sheep into another area of the site. Because of the wire management, our strategy is natural animal movement. So instead of, like, I mean, it's fundamentally a paradigm shift for me, is we're not pushing the livestock anymore. We want to pull them across the site. So that is how we're managing the sheep on the farms right now, in this whole matter of getting them to move naturally into areas where we need to increase intensity or reduce intensity of the grazing.
So what do you think would be the maximum number you would have? I mean, you're just going to have to wait to find out all the factors.
That's a great question. So
that's what earlier, but it wasn't included.
Post dryland wheat fallow, we have a significant amount of nitrogen in the soil, right? So the years post-construction are going to have a significant amount, higher levels, I predict, of biomass generated which we are seeing at a site that we're working on right now. So we're going to have to stock at a very high level, probably at 1 to 1.5 animals or ewes per acre in the spring, and then we'll just bring that number right down once it cures out. You know, we know in this climate, once the grass cures out, and if we have a healthy grass ecosystem, we don't have thistle generation, right? So half of this goes back to having good seed in the soil to make sure that we get that healthy ecosystem, which we see on our native rangeland. So we just need to reduce the biomass so we don't have fire.
So you're doing this somewhere else right now?
Yes, sir.
Where?
Currently working on the Apache Waywit site that Elaine mentioned. That's the Shetler Flat site there out of Arlington. Also working on another site for that same company.
You're grazing there now, or you're going to? Or?
No, we're grazing there right now. We just mobilized another group of sheep today, got some paperwork in line. But the Shetler site, we've been on Shetler site, it came out of construction 120 days out there.
So what kind of forage is in there?
Drive-by Shetler. It's got a vegetative management plan that I hope is permitted and discussed about ahead of time. And I'll speak honestly. I have been actively engaged in all the solar development in this county for some time, and in Gillam County and Sherman County and Wasco County, and I've been at it for several months, and only recently got the opportunity to work on the Shetler site, and this is the first company that's actually called me. And living in this county, I think it's great that we have our land anchored, armored for wind erosion and water discharge, and as we know with our current water situation, I don't want, you know, I want pure infiltrating water going into our soil that's clean. So I think having a sound vegetated cover under these panels is, if we're going to permit them in our county, is the direction we need to head.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Okay. Is there any more questions?
Do you have your order, your order of operations there, Vice Chair?
Your checklist.
Okay.
Maybe call for opposition.
Yeah, so I'm working my way down through this. Are we going to start with conflicts of interest? Shouldn't we have already done that?
Should have already done that.
Yeah,
well,
good for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so at this point in time, it looks like I'm asking for the opponents first, is that correct?
Well, the proponents already, and people in favor.
Well, I didn't know if there was any further proponents is what I was asking.
Oh, is it? Are we opening a public comment?
Yeah.
Yeah, is there any further?
Not effectively, but yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't.
No deal.
Did you make some changes to that? It's just like applicants, proponents,
yeah.
Opponents, agencies.
Yeah.
So there's no further proponents, and so then is there anyone that wants to speak in opposition to this?
You guys probably don't.
You gotta come up to the table, you'll get away with this, Ken.
Yeah. Probably don't want to listen to me very long. My name's Tim Rust, T-I-M-R-U-S-T, 77252 Mater Rust Lane, Echo. Just a little history of our farm. Shannon's folks bought the farm in 1979 and added 2,500 acres in 1985. And then in around 1995, the family sold off 9,000 acres or so to the Madison family, which is north of where the solar project's going to be, and it is now into irrigated high-value farm crops, and also it demands more labor. So we, as a family, are not opposed to change. I think a lot of this stuff I'm just going to skip. We're really tickled to have the Krebs family part of our project, and as these guys know, we hammered on them pretty hard about weed control. Can't hardly stand seeing too many weeds on a place. But so we're tickled about that. And so, but we are farmers at heart, so we
you know, we don't want to really want a big project, so this kind of fits our family style. It's going to be about 7.5% of our, we farm. And just seems like with, I think, as we're talking about how hard it is, you know, with input costs the way they are, it seems like we have our own USDA that does their best to keep the prices below production costs. And just the many things that come against us as trying to farm, we just felt like we needed to hedge our income a little bit and add into something that's pretty stable, at least for a few years. So. Anyway, questions? Probably not for me.
Trip has his hand raised. Yes. John, I wanted to, I know the Russ pretty well, really good friends with them. I just wanted to abstain when we vote for that reason. Okay. That was all.
You can, you're sure welcome to do that. In this county, sometimes, you know, we're all friends.
Yeah.
So that would be
great. Right.
Some of us already have solar farms.
Yeah.
I'm going to speak again. Is that all right, sir?
You were answering some questions before, but now you can speak as a proponent.
Cameron Krebs, Boardman resident, 68171 Coonsey Lane. First of all, thank you all your commissioners for your time and service to Morrow County. I appreciate that you are looking avidly in the vegetative management plan, as previous stated. I'm a big proponent that we need to armor our soil underneath these solar farms going forward. I also